Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Of course, that was Natalie Cole. And we start the day off with her. Remembering her, passed away at 65. She was one of, I think, of our great iconic cultural figures. Passed away at 65 years old and fought heroin addiction, fought many things and affected her body, but she never stopped being full of life at the very end in her clean stages as well, and gave us so much. And so we'll remember Natalie Cole to start with. And also, we were on the holiday, we lost Dr. Francis Cress Wessling, who was a very interesting and profound, complicated psychiatrist and thinker around race and in our society. She passed away at age 80, I think it was.
Wow.
And we also lost a man that many of you may not know, but who I knew well and who'd been on this program a few times, Dr. Sidney Mintz, who was 93 years old and just agile of mind and a brilliant human being, who was the father of food anthropology and made these really complex theories about race, class, the third world, and how our food fit into the development of capitalism and more. A brilliant thinker, retired from Hopkins. He was 93 and fell and hit his head and died. But and I would say only 93 because he was still cooking. I want to remember those three people who have left us over the last few days here at the end of 2015. And in some of those people, we will do some more of us to memorialize and some shows coming up in the coming weeks here on the Mark Steiner Show, which I think we need to do. So let me introduce our guest, and then we'll jump into our conversations here. We have with us today, back with us, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, who is a co-host and a host here on the Mark Steiner Show and associate professor on our other job, American Studies, at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and co-editor of Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Black Body Politics, Body Politics, and Africana Communities. Neil Franklin, former Baltimore and Maryland State police officer, was a major when he retired, and also was deeply involved in police training in both those jobs as executive director of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And Jackie Wellfonder joins us, who is political consultant at the Wellfonder Group. So Jackie, Neil, and Kimberly, welcome. Good to have you all here.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Great to have you here. And you all join us, please, at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages. But if you have a moment, 410-319-8888. We were talking before we went on the air. I mean, it's almost hard to begin a conversation about where we are sitting here in Baltimore without talking about, which we will do the next hour as well, the 344 murders that took place in the city, which were more murders than took place in New York City, or as many in New York City, which is a city of 8 million people. And we have a city of 620,000. And Kimberly Moffitt was talking about how in Greensboro, North Carolina, which she just visited, that there was a town of population slightly less than Baltimore with only 53,000, 53, I mean, murders that took place. 34 numbers.
So 10 times as many. Yeah.
So so begin this year. We have to wrestle with this. I mean, I know that I have a bunch of thoughts on it, but let me just, Neil, why don't you get us off? This is the heart of much of the work you do.
Yeah, and you just mentioned two areas. You mentioned Greensboro. You mentioned New York City and the difference between a murder rate there and Baltimore. And I think a lot of it has to do with poverty, the extreme poverty conditions that we have in Baltimore. And it's not just isolated to one area of Baltimore. We have these conditions in East Baltimore, West Baltimore, Southwest Baltimore, Northwest Baltimore, just about anywhere you go outside of the downtown area and due north of downtown, you can find these pockets of plight. And we also have, to go with that, a very busy, active, lucrative drug trade. So when you combine the two, extreme conditions of poverty and a flourishing drug trade, it's a perfect combination for the violence that goes along with that, especially when you have a police department that is right smack in the middle of it, trying to do something about it, disrupting the trade on a daily basis. And anytime you disrupt such a trade, you're going to have violence that follows it as you continue to make the arrest and you create employment opportunities for new people to take over a corner, for another gang to take over a corner, another crew to take over a corner, and there's going to be some fighting in the process. And from that, you have retaliation. And that continues to go back and forth time and time again. And the final piece here is when you have a police department that does not have an effective relationship with the community so that they can solve these murders, so that they can, you know, a lot of these murders are committed by the same people over and over again. But if the community is not engaged with the police to give information that is critical, that is needed for finding, and not just finding these people, but making a solid case on these people who are committing the murders, then they will continue to murder. And that's, you know, so those things, those three things that I mentioned are key to the violence that we have here in Baltimore City and why it continues at the rate that it does.
Yeah, I would agree. Poverty certainly is at the top of my list. And when I think about this through the lens of our public schools, 85% of our students are typically students that before we received this major grant to take care of lunch for all students, 85% of our students were receiving free or reduced lunch.
Right.
So that speaks mounds about the type of student that we have in our school buildings, but also it speaks mounds about the families that they are coming from. And so when we're talking about a level of economic despair that many of our families are in, poverty is clearly at the center of much of what we are experiencing here in the city. And then I would also say limited opportunities. Like, I want to be out of poverty, so where are the opportunities in order for me to tap into or attach to so that I can? And I think those opportunities are so limited in the city that there are more people who, although interested in rising above that despair, remain in that same spot, not being able to make a difference.
Jackie, you want to jump in on this one?
Well, sure. Ironically, I was with a group of people this weekend, and we were putting together boxes to send overseas to the troops. Well, there were letters that were included from students, and one of the letters was from one of the poorest counties on the Eastern Shore here, and I'm just speaking briefly on that. But it just was profound to me because in this letter, this young student was actually saying that basically they were asking the person they were sending the letter to kind of keep them in their thoughts because they specifically said they were trying very hard not to get involved in drugs, not to get involved with selling drugs. And it was just so profound to me because I think a lot of people aren't very aware of what types of environments that these young people are coming from and how limited they feel their options are. And I completely agree with the community reaching out because I think without doing that and having a certain level of empathy for what these families are experiencing, you know, we're not going to be able to control this problem.
So folks, do join us at 410-319-8888. And I've just been pondering the 344 people that we lost in the streets of Baltimore this year. It's just a huge number of people. And all the stats are up in the city in terms of crime. And it's mirrored in other cities. It's mirrored in Chicago and other places around the country. I think that there are communities, you know, if you look, when they say the murder rate's low in New York, I have not done the study yet, but I wonder what it is in certain neighborhoods per capita, right? You can take 8 million people, but if you take the poorest communities, what is the murder rate on the poorest communities in New York City? You know,
right, and that's a very important point because one of the things that I mentioned about Baltimore and the uniqueness of Baltimore and the poor areas of Baltimore, how they scattered throughout the entire city for the most part. When you go to other cities, major cities around the country, and you know, people tell you, well, make sure you avoid this particular area or that particular, you know, this is where the high crime rate is. It's usually one, maybe two areas,
right,
you know, that they mention to you. But, you know, in Baltimore, it's okay, yeah, it's here, it's there, it's up here, it's there, it's a pocket here, there's a pocket there. And so that's very important. And it's easier for law enforcement in those cities where you have one particular area or two particular areas, it's much easier for law enforcement to get a handle on the violent crime in those particular areas than it is in a city like Baltimore.
But let me take it in a direction which you said and pull out this last thought you had about the police and containing it. But the other side is you have situations like in Cleveland where Tamir Rice is killed by this officer. It's happened over and over again, exonerated. not indicted, I should say, by the grand jury, Kimberly. And it's you know, and that part of the issue here we're facing is this divide that I think is deepening in America. Poverty is swelling, especially especially in black and brown communities, but also the white world. Poverty is growing exponentially, but the responses in some ways are different because of race in America to that. But this is a complex piece where people are talking about, I want my neighborhood safe, but I don't want my 12-year-old boy being shot by the police.
And I'm one of those. I don't want my 11-year-old boy being shot. Mm. And the reality is we find ourselves, especially as black and brown parents, worrying about things like that so that our children don't necessarily get to feel like they are completely children. My brother gave my son one of these Nerf guns over Christmas. Mm. And I remember immediately going to Twitter and saying, my son, this won't even see the light of day. Because I worry how people will respond to him playing with something that clearly is a toy, but because of the body that is holding that toy, responding to it very differently. So we keep hearing about, especially since the Tamir Rice or the lack of indictment in his case occurred recently, we keep hearing about the research that the American Psychological Association has done to talk about black children being seen very differently than other races of children. And so by the time a black boy reaches the age of 9, the way that we respond to that body is very different than we do for other races. They're not seen as children. They, in fact, are ripped or stripped away from the opportunity to be seen, to have that childlike innocence. And then, as a result, are engaged by other adults, and in particular law enforcement, as though they are adults, and also are always guilty instead of being innocent until proven guilty.
And let me just add here before we go back to Jackie and open the phones here to our callers who are calling in. This is coming from somebody, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, who does not live in an inner city neighborhood, who lives in a middle class neighborhood where the likelihood of gunplay is low.
Yes.
Right? But the
reality, it's still not happening.
Exactly. No, I hear you. No, that's what I'm saying is that's the way from the other side of the equation in terms of the police and law enforcement and our attitudes in this culture, that where even though it may be intensified and much deeper in the poor communities because of the history of this country, it becomes a question much broader than that.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's complex for most of non-black America to wrestle with in many
absolutely
ways.
Absolutely. Because they don't see it as being something that is an epidemic to all black folks. They think that it is something that is relegated to particular areas where there is high crime. But the reality is the experience of being a black woman, a black person in this country, all of those experiences, although the socioeconomic status may not be the same, is still very much a reality. I left home this morning and my husband said, one of your headlights is out. You need to stop and have it fixed. And I said, as long as you aren't driving the car today, I know I'm going to be okay. So what does that say? Because nobody else in a white home is having that same conversation. That I even have to think about the safety of my spouse based on something as small as a headlight being out.
So Jackie, because it happened in your world, or most of the white world, would be maybe watch that headlight. We should get that fixed. You don't want to get a ticket.
Right. That's a conversation.
Right?
You're right. I mean, there is a difference. And, I mean, we saw that with this case where, again, I go back to this. But, I mean, first of all, I wish people would do the research and read about this particular case before they speak on it. And, I mean, when you have Jeb Bush making statements like he said, and, I mean, yes, I'm right of center. But, I mean, something like that, I think, makes us look ridiculous and completely not empathetic. I mean, he was talking on this case, but yet he confused it with another case. And then when he responded to that, he said, I'm sorry, my bad. And I'm like, seriously, that's your response? I mean, that's ridiculous. It just looks horrible. And I think, I don't know, maybe people just need to think a little more before they speak. But the bottom line is they need to recognize that, yes, there are differences, huge differences.
And I think, again, I'm going to open the phone here. This is not necessarily a conservative, liberal, left, right issue. It's a human rights issue. I think there's a complexity. I mean, there's a lot of racism inside the conservative movement, but being conservative doesn't mean you're racist.
That's right.
Right? I mean, that's really an important thing.
That's right.
And also there are a lot of liberal racists, I might add.
That's right. Yeah.
but just real quick, you know, historically in this country, this country has always viewed blacks as criminal, as violent people, as dangerous people. I mean, you can go back 100 years, you can go back to slavery, you can go back to, let me just put it this way. That's always been a view of black people for this country. But, and you know I'm going to go here, the war on drugs has taken it to another level, especially with our young. You know, and the series like The Wire, you know, now not just here in this country, but when I travel to South America, when I travel to Europe, and people find out I'm from Baltimore, the first thing they ask me about is The Wire.
Right.
You know, and they see the images of young black children, black boys, on the corners, slinging drugs, carrying the guns. And this is something that is carried in the minds of people, and mainly law enforcement, as they go out into the streets to enforce these laws.
No matter whether
you get a call for a black, you know, teen or young man with a gun, and of course we know all that. You know, everything wasn't communicated to those officers, not that it makes it right as to how they responded. But you get that call, and automatically in their minds, they're going to respond a certain way because they're thinking a certain way about that person who's on the other end of that call that they're responding to. And that leads to their actions and how they responded to Tamir Rice.
Let me open the phones here before we move on to some other subjects that happened in this course this year and how they affect us. 410-319-8888. Mel, on line one, you're on the air. Welcome. Mel? Mel, you there? All right, let's go. Mel, hold on. We'll come back to you. Let's go to Earl on line two. Welcome.
Yes, good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Earl.
Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you.
This is Earl Alamine.
Oh, Earl, how are you?
I'm doing
good
well,
friend.
Very well.
Imam Alamine, good to have you with us.
Mark, I just wanted to say you and your guests had spoken about Chicago and Baltimore and the murder rates, and then you talked about New York, and you hadn't finished doing a study. One of the things that's important to understand that the most segregated cities in the United States are Baltimore and Chicago, and as it relates to housing. And when you look at that, then the murder rates are going to be escalate in those two cities. The other thing with what you talked about going around the country, around the world, and I travel around the world, and your guest is absolutely correct. The Wire is the first thing that people talk to me about. So one of the things that we always tell our young people is television and movies are very, very devastating because what you see is not what you get. What you see is what gets you. So it's on that end of the thing, we're seeing people who are being influenced by the television, and so children of color, especially African American males and Hispanic males, are deemed as criminal. They're seen as criminal. So. The officers their training is very minimal as it relates to that, so we got a lot of work to do in order to negate a lot of these negative impacts on our community and how we're being impacted, and that television is very, very important in housing and communities and how people, especially Baltimore and Chicago, very, very segregated housing. Very segregated.
You raised an important point. Let's wrestle with that. And I'm so much good to have you. Looking forward to coming back as a guest very soon. Earl Amin is one of our leading imams in this community who I've known forever. But, you know, when you look at it, he's right. As he was speaking, I was looking at where the highest murder rates are in America. Baltimore ranks 13th, actually.
Which is about the size of our population. I mean, in terms of largest population.
But when you think, listen to the other cities. And there's one thing all these cities have in common. East St. Louis, Camden, Gary, Chester, Saginaw, Michigan, Flint, Michigan, Detroit, Michigan, Trenton, New Jersey, New Orleans, Newark, New Jersey, Harvey, Illinois, St. Louis, Missouri, and just after Baltimore is Compton, and just after Compton at number 15 is East Chicago. Not Chicago, East Chicago.
East Chicago,
right?
Right.
East Chicago. So what do these places have in common?
Well, the segregation.
And deep poverty in all these cities.
Deep poverty,
deep
segregation.
Poverty in every one of these cities.
You know, and as we were talking about how the police respond to young black men and the shootings that come from that and the murders that come at the hands of the police, I'm going to throw a little wrench in here in this conversation. These communities you just mentioned with these high murder rates, including Baltimore, in those areas of Baltimore and would you say East Chicago. Right? They are dangerous communities. Okay? Our young black men do kill each other and other people get caught in a crossfire. You know, so as a law enforcement person, even if I want to be good and want to treat people, you know, with the most, the highest level of dignity and respect, I think I would be a little off center if I approached that work in those communities as if it is safe, if you understand what I'm saying. So I am going to be cautious. I am going to be leery because just as you talked about here, the murder rate and the people and the number of guns that are being carried concealed by people, you know, our young black men in these communities is higher. My chances of being shot are extremely high. So I'm just throwing that out there. Not saying that I agree with everything, but I'm just throwing it out there. The mindset that these police officers have that are working in these communities where we know it's a fact that the murder rates are extremely high. We see it. We feel it. We hear the gunshots while we're in there working. You know, we know of the people who are being shot. We know of the violence. Okay, so it's a challenge. That's a challenge.
So, and my pushback to that is, so where does change happen? If we hold on to that mindset as law enforcement officials and we are operating within a community where we recognize that level of violence is occurring, so where does change happen? Where do we make this shift to say this is how we have to do it differently in order to create a community that looks very different? Mm-hmm. Or do we stay in our silos and keep the same mindset? Because, in fact, what I would argue is doing it that way just exacerbates the issue. And so where we are with 344 doesn't change. I mean, something else happens much greater, and next year may be equivalent to the same number of days in a year at 365 instead of 344.
So thank you. Here's my point. Have we really, really asked the question of why people are shooting people? We go after the guns, and we have these conversations about the guns. Oh, it's too many guns. We need more. Look, people who are carrying the guns don't care about the laws.
Mm-hmm. And don't have any legally anyway.
Why are our young black men, and in some cases kids, shooting at one another and others?
And Jackie, let me let you kind of comment on this as we go to break here. And I think that I was thinking, let me just say very quickly, I was thinking about comments we've made here, is that there's so many people I talk to who talk to us and talk to this program about walking out of their houses every day, living around abandominiums, terrified of young men with guns on the street, but also terrified of the men and women in blue or whatever color people wear now in the street with guns.
Absolutely.
So that's the bind mm-hmm. that people, especially in poverty, mm-hmm. find themselves in. Jackie, your thought before we go to break.
Well, I understand for these officers it's a difficult balance, but I think regardless they have to be careful not to let personal biases come into play. I mean, with this situation with Tamir, it seems like everything happened very, very quickly, and there wasn't a lot of assessment done in advance. And I mean, as far as where does change happen, I mean, I just know for us locally, there's been a lot of effort to get community involved and to have meetings and town halls and mediators involved, to have people communicating with parents, children, and the police officers, and having police officers spend more time in community. So I don't know what all the answers are, but I just hope at some point there will be more effort for people to sit around the same table and communicate to some of these preconceived notions and biases can be squelched by actual communication and looking each other in the eye.
We're going to take a very short break. Our next caller up is Dee at 410-319-8888. Join us here. We're going to kind of bring some other issues into the fray here, including the controversies around Bill Cosby, how they fit into all this, and what's happening in Oregon, which will also bleed into the next hour. But please join us now, 410-319-8888. Sorry for the word bleed. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here as we talk to Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Baltimore, Maryland, Baltimore County, and co-editor of Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities, as well as being a co-host and guest host here on the Mark Steiner Show. Neil Franklin, former Baltimore and Maryland State Trooper, retired major, where he ran a lot of the training programs, Executive Director of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, Jackie Wellfonder, who is political consultant at Wellfonder Group. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let me get a quick call in here, and then I'm going to kind of tie some other things that have happened outside of Baltimore and how they might fit or not fit into our conversation here. But bring us your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Dee, on line one, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dee.
I was calling because you all were talking about what the cities had in common, and I wanted to make the comment that they all Democrat-ran cities. And I also wanted to make the comment and agree with the gentleman on your panel is that it is definitely the area that you live in, because when I was working in Baltimore City, the police – I live in the county. But when I was working in Baltimore City, the police in Baltimore City is a little bit more aggressive and a little bit more suspicious versus the police officers in the county. And I've been stopped because my job was to be in the street a lot, so I was very cautious in certain neighborhoods that I went in. But where I would get a ticket in Baltimore City, I would just get a warning, or the police would stop and say, well, you know, you were going 5, 10, whatever miles over the speed limit, and warn me verbally. So it does depend on the area that, you know, the police approach you in. And that was all I had to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Comments on...
Well, yeah, we obviously do police differently in different areas, and she's very right about that. But overall, how the police generally view young black men tends to be the same across all policing demographics, and not just in the police community. You know, most of the citizens in this country also see young black men the same way, so we have to acknowledge that as well. I just wanted to make a quick comment, because you were talking about Tamir, you know, and I think Jackie was talking about Tamir and his situation. This was tactically wrong from the start of this call, putting all, you know, perspectives aside on how we view young black men. But, you know, from the beginning, all the information wasn't communicated to the police officers.
Right.
Okay. Then you had their approach. Their approach was completely wrong. The senior officer, the driver of the car, put that junior officer in danger if this was a real situation. If they thought it to be a real situation, a very dangerous situation, an active shooter situation, as they put it, why you wouldn't approach too quickly and too close, putting that junior officer right next to the potential shooter. Mm-hmm. So that was statically wrong. You know, and then there was the communication, the lack of proper communication that would have been established if you had approached properly. But then something else that really, really twerks me is afterwards, 8 minutes and no medical attention given to Tamir. You know, none of the officers, the paramedics were even slow to respond walking to Tamir. There was no urgency. And then I believe it was his sister who was handcuffed, approaching and put in the car. I mean, so how they viewed her and what they did with her was also wrong. There are so many things wrong with this.
And if they thought Tamir was actually an adult, which is what they said, Ohio is an open carry state.
That's another thing.
It's not. Well, and to me,
no such thing. Mark, there's no such thing for a young black man in an open carry state. That's an oxymoron.
But if Tamir, it was a 5'7", 170-pound, 12-year-old who was white carrying a gun, the response also may have been very different. Yeah. I mean, these are all pieces of
this
puzzle.
Yeah, you could look at the videos and see
it. It would have been a conversation. But again, we're in a place and time in our society where black bodies are expendable. And so it didn't seem problematic to nullify this situation in that two-second period from the moment the officer jumped out of the car.
So, Jackie, I'm going to jump in on this, and I'm going to open the phones. I'm going to throw a different subject out here, then go to Mike and Kenneth, and the caller's waiting. Go ahead.
Well, I would just say it breaks my heart to hear that word expendable, but unfortunately, she's correct. I mean, there's just a different perception, and until people acknowledge that, these issues are going to continue. And it's just heartbreaking to me the way this whole situation was handled, especially with this particular officer's history. I don't really understand how things ended up the way they did.
But, you know, it's interesting because even as I talked on Twitter this weekend about Tamir Rice, I was amazed at the number of vitriolic responses that I was receiving saying, how can you defend this little thug? Or even the Twitter feed that was going around where the wrong picture of a young black boy holding guns was said to be Tamir Rice and was not, and the number of people who were justifying saying, see, this is the so-called innocent 12-year-old everyone keeps trying to defend, and it wasn't even that particular child. But even greater than that, and maybe this is the mother part of this academic speaking, how problematic is it that we can get to a point to be so cavalier about a 12-year-old losing their lives in this country and not have some kind of uproar to say enough is enough? Like, that is where the buck should stop. But even then, what we find ourselves doing is recognizing this is another part of the fabric of what we've been dealing with in terms of police brutality, and we just lump it in with all the others and we move forward.
So let me ask you, I just want to jump in. Let me ask this other question here. There are two things that were on my mind here. And Mike, you're the next caller. We're going to come right to your call and then to Kenneth's call. The latest news we've seen at the end of this year was that two pieces happened. One was 150 men took over federal property in Oregon, in Barnes, Oregon, I believe.
White men. You forgot that
piece. I haven't gotten there yet.
Okay.
he's getting there.
That's important.
He's getting there.
Took away my stuff. And
sorry. It's just too important.
I was going there. And I said, and the response is from the Barnes police, from the police in Oregon, we're not going there, we're not touching it, we're not getting anywhere near this. And so, and I hearken back to the early 70s and other stuff, and I was thinking about Wounded Knee and Alcatraz, which are two federal lands that Native people took over. Because there actually is a law on the books that says if you have an abandoned piece of federal land, it reverts back to the tribe that's closest to it, which is actually in the law. But when both of these things happened, it was an armed police response. Or if, let's say, in Baltimore City or anywhere else or in East Chicago, that a number of black men who were armed took over City Hall and saying, we're staying here until we get – and we're taking over this place and we're going to be here and live here until we have the services we need in the community.
Yeah, and not only that, in some of these cities, you would think that City Hall was abandoned, wouldn't you? But anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. But yeah. So, but I'm just saying that –
right. Different response.
Let's talk – I mean, we see that. I mean, this is – but lead into the next thing I want to bring up, but there's a really different way that we respond to these things because you see a lot of talk radio defending what's going on, congressmen defending the men in Oregon, saying they are not terrorists. This is not – there's nothing – they did the correct thing. So how to respond to this? Jackie, let me start you on this one, then we can go around the table before we open the phones.
Well, this is so frustrating to me because I think no matter the circumstance, people are quick to label. Just like we were talking about Tamir, people are quick to make assumptions about this 12-year-old and who he was. And I mean, in this case, I think first of all, I mean, you're talking about the difference in this being a white group of people. I think if people refuse to acknowledge the fact that if this group of people were black, there would be a different perception. I think if they refuse to acknowledge that, they're fooling themselves. And I mean, for me, as someone who community activism is hugely important, I mean, one of the things these people are talking about is government overreach and those sorts of things. But my thing is, I see a lot of people who love jumping on a bandwagon like this But when it comes to city council meetings, county council meetings, or becoming a part of the process where they could actually change legislation, I don't see them there. But when it comes to a circumstance like this, they're all for it waving the flag, and I think there has to be a balance. There has to be both. And I just don't think this is the way to address this particular issue.
The men are thugs. They just don't have the – because of who controls the narrative, they don't get labeled that way. But this is no different than much of the so-called many of the very peaceful protests that have happened through the Black Lives Matter movement over the last couple of years. The difference is the body, and the body is a particular color, so we read that body very differently, even if they don't have arms, which many of these peaceful protests, there isn't any weapon. However, by virtue of whose body is carrying out the message, the fact that the media allows a certain narrative to be constructed and reinforced, these men become patriots. These men are seen as those who are willing to stand for their rights and what it means to be an American citizen. Although I constantly remind my students that the right to peaceful protest also is a part of what it means to be an American citizen in this country. So the idea that we construct these two groups of people very differently is nothing but sheer race.
Yeah, and we've had this happen before in the southwest part of the country. I think it might have been Arizona, one of the southwest states, where we had some folks coming together, white folks, in the same manner, protecting ranchers.
Well, that, and as a matter of fact, just to jump in, it's the son of the man who did that action is leading this action.
Is leading this one.
Right. So, I mean, it's nothing new. And, you know, along the same lines as you were also talking about the victim, is how we vilify Tamir Rice, for instance. Now we start digging back. Oh, you know, he was this or he was that. And we do this time and time again for these young black men who are killed at the hands of police. We go back and we start digging and we try to figure out how we can vilify them, you know, to try to justify their actions in some sense. But think about how we view or this country, when it's involving one of these young white male mass shooting suspects. You know, now the conversation is troubled childhood.
Yep.
Oh, some
mental health
problems or conditions. Yep. He was bullied and you know, set aside in high school or whatever the case may be. It seems to be completely different, and that's something that we have to wrestle with and deal with also.
Yep. Let me go to the phones and we'll come back. I'm going to tie something else in here if we can. 410-319-8888. Mike, line one, you're on the air.
Yes. Good morning to Mr. Stein and your panel. Can y'all hear
me? Happy New Year.
Okay. Happy New Year. Basically, I just wanted to just make a general statement. You know, European white people pretty much stole America, and then set up their policies and laws to benefit them. But for one, white people are going to always feel they have the right to bear arms. You know, as far as protecting themselves, because they know their ancestors, legally, illegally stole this land. Bouncing back to black people and the high murder rate, we just got to be accountable for our own actions, and we have to stand up to the plate, stop copping out. Of course, cops has always did what they did. It's just the fact that it might have came out more because of the video camera, but pretty much they've always did that. So it's up to us to protect our children. Like the little boy shouldn't have never even had been playing with a toy gun. His parents should have warned him that you're still in America as a black male, so you targeted. So it's like we got to be accountable for our actions, and it's still going to take a lot of work for a lot of racist people to wake up and see that you know, even though you stole this country, you're not the only people that live in this country. Thank you.
So I appreciate that comment, but what I always hearken back to is the idea that we place so much of a burden on black parents in particular about how they need to educate and school their children or what they're supposed to do not to allow something to happen. But we don't do that same thing or take that same stance with white children. So we can have all of these young white males, you know, commit mass murders or commit mass shootings, and all of a sudden it's it's something about their mental health state. Well, where is the responsibility of the parents to deal with their mental health concerns? And we never place that burden on white parents. It's always about what black parents haven't done or didn't do to prepare and keep their children safe and not participating in certain actions. But white parents never have to carry that burden in the same way. It's always outside of them, and it relegates specifically with the individual and no one else.
So, Jackie, may I ask this question? I've wrestled with, and we're talking about here a lot about what how to address this question. But, I mean, so how do you bring that conversation that we just heard, that Kimberly kind of eloquently kind of portrayed, to the larger world? How do you take that conversation into the more conservative world, which is mostly in this country, more conservative white world? How do you make that conversation happen?
I think the biggest way is, I mean, for one thing, people have to be willing to step out of the box. Like here locally, we had a protest here locally. It was called a die-in. And I think there was a lot of people within my circle that automatically made the assumption that there would be no place for them there, that there would be no need for them to go, where I wish if some of them had just gone to see what it would be like. I mean, there were some preconceived notions that that it may turn violent, you know, that it may be this dangerous environment. And I think first and foremost, I mean, yes, these are uncomfortable topics, but unless people are willing to be a part of the conversation, nothing's going to change. And I mean, so I think that's a big part of it. People need to be willing to step out of their comfort zone.
Before we go back to phones, let's go back. There was another topic. Kenneth, we're going to come right to you. Let me just raise this issue, because I think that another big piece of news happened at the end of the year here was Bill Cosby being indicted and being brought to trial. And again, I think this shows kind of about the criminal justice system and divide in America in terms of how people perceive what happened here. And I kind of was really looking at that actually on Facebook. Facebook's come such a crazy place because all the conversations take place and you can kind of see this back and forth, at least on my pages, because my pages are so racially and politically mixed. Mm-hmm. To kind of read all these kind of different thoughts about a subject coming from all these sectors is fascinating to me to see different points. But this has been this has really been a touchstone in around criminal justice and race. I said, what are your thoughts on the media? I'm watching my dear friend here, Neil, and your face reactions. So I can't see you, Jackie. So let me go to Neil here.
Talking about wrestling with stuff, man, I tell you. Now, you know, I grew up with Bill Cosby. I'm 57 years old. I grew up with Bill Cosby ever since, from listening to his records as a comedian, you know, and then into the Cosby Show and to everything that's come from that, you know, philanthropy, just following this guy. And, you know, when he was here in town for Robert Townsend's Meter Man filming in Reservoir Hill, I was there on a set with him there. And then, you know, to have this come out. Now, here's the other side of me. I used to be the board president for Turnaround Incorporated, which is an organization here in Baltimore City, Baltimore County, which is an advocate organization for women who are victims of rape. And, you know, I testified down in Annapolis as to the use of date rape drugs, you know, Rohypnol and some others. And he's talking about Quaaludes. And now I go back to listen to some of the stuff he was saying decades ago about, you know, the Spanish fly and stuff, and now these things are starting to come together. Now, you know, and now there's a lot of smoke with all these women coming forward saying that this happened and that happened. Despite what I just said about growing up with this guy and, you know, and the race implications here and so on, I'm sorry. I have no sympathy for the man. I just don't. I have no sympathy for him. Now, the issues that come from this situation as far as race in this country and justice and a justice system, which we know is deplorable and broken, that's another story. But for the man himself, I have absolutely no sympathy for him.
Right.
Jackie, go ahead. Then we'll turn over to Kimberly.
Well, I mean, I'm coming from the same place. I mean, I grew up with Bill Cosby. I adored him. I loved Fat Albert. I loved The Cosby Show. I still, even up until recently, was someone that watched the repeats because I felt like it helped me reconnect to my youth. I loved him as a character. I loved the warmth and the family dynamic that they had. I think it gave people, you know, a different impression of what
an African-American family look like. I just thought the show was incredible. I loved it. And, I mean, with this particular circumstance, I agree. I'm heartbroken. One of the articles we were looking at was saying how this sexual assault charge leaves many feeling betrayed. And that's kind of how I feel. I mean, this was someone I respected and I looked up to. And I felt like he was a real role model, and I love the way he carried himself. And it's just, I mean, yeah, it's incredibly disappointing. But I think on the same token, I think that people should be careful with how they're portraying this as well, because, like, there's already been parodies put out there about the Cosby Show, and I just don't think that's helpful. I think some of that stuff, and again, I don't know, I'm probably in the minority on this, but, I mean, I think it's in poor taste, and I don't think it's helpful.
Yeah, I'm not even focused on Cosby, to be honest. My focus is on the victims and his family who are having to contend with this issue.
Right.
And some of the victims who have come forward have spoken about this being decades old. Mm-hmm. And so what has been their experience in trying to work through some of what they feel like has occurred? Now, I don't want to suggest that I've already said that he's guilty, because I do believe in the process going forth and allowing that process to make a determination. But there is a great deal of smoke that says something to us. And certainly, even if there is a huge expose that reveals that none of this is accurate, which I think is very implausible, but even if that were to occur, it still has done the damage already in terms of how we look at the individual as well as his body of work, unfortunately. But I also think it's important for us to hold on to the fact of how complex we are as human beings, and to recognize that for all the good that one does, there's also aspects of them that many of us may not care for or like. So when we hearken back to many of the universities where students want names changed of buildings because, you know, there's this history or connection to slavery regarding it. Those individuals were seen as stellar and pillars of their communities, but they also had this complexity about them that we don't like, that we find to be problematic. And I think for most individuals that we end up revering, that is exactly who they are. I mean, we can look at the Malcolm X's, we can look at the Martin Luther King's and say the same thing about such individuals. Certainly not anything like what Cosby has done, but in terms of recognizing that all of this good that they have contributed to society, there are aspects of them that are flawed and problematic.
One thing that's just really quick that about this particular case, when you look at some people who have had, you know, difficulties in their life and some problems, as you just mentioned there, Kimberly, there seems to be a point in their life where they turn the corner and things change, right?
Yeah.
You know, you get older, you're supposed to get wiser, you're supposed to become a little bit more mature. But when you look at this situation, I mean, this last case that we're talking about, one he's being criminally charged for, this isn't that far long ago.
It's a little over a decade ago. Is it 2004?
Right. It's 2004.
Yeah, 2004.
I mean, so, you know, if this had been something that had occurred three decades ago,
70s.
And then it kind of like stopped, and then, you know, you could kind of think, well, the guy, you know, he came to his senses and things, he now changed his ways. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that somewhere along the line you would hope
that's important.
Things would change.
Let me try to get a call in here, and of course, we don't get all your calls. You can also bleed into the next hour. We have some spiritual thinkers coming in and talk about some of these very same issues as well, so we can continue this. 410-319-8888. Kenneth, you're on the air, line two.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Kenneth.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just want to get back on the war on drugs again, if you don't mind, and then I'll give you a quick analysis on cars.
We only have 2 minutes, so you better have to do it very fast.
Oh, okay. I'm going to do it. Oh, this is going to be real quick. I lived on Baltimore Street about 10 years ago, and on one side, black people lived, and they were selling drugs, and everything was fine. On the other side, there were white people on what they call the South Baltimore, Pig Town, whatever you want to call it, and they were coming over to the black, people's side. And it wasn't until then that they started this big war on drugs. The police were jumping out of trucks and cars. But as long as the blacks were selling drugs among themselves, and we all know this, they didn't do a thing. But as soon as the South Side people came, which were white people. It was a big deal, you know. So I just want to get that out. And Bill Cosby, the woman said she wants more money. He said, I'm not giving you any more money. Have some Jell-O and coconut smile. And so she went and got 12 more of her girlfriends.
Well, can I have to interrupt you, because that's absolutely not true. I mean, it really isn't true. I mean, she didn't get 12 girlfriends. There were dozens of women who have said this has happened to them from across America.
Right.
Black, white, Latino,
again,
Asian.
Throughout all, time.
all kinds of women. Yeah. And it was not something he made up. And I would also just say I grew up in Baltimore as well. The Pigtown was always a neighborhood that was poor white and poor black, mm-hmm. living in the same community across the road from one another. That was the whole thing about being in Southwest Baltimore. It was this black, white, inner city, poor neighborhood. It's always been that way.
Well, I will say this, though, but until heroin and opiates became a problem in Harford County and Carroll County and Anne Arundel County,
right.
It wasn't a problem. Now it's an epidemic, right?
Right.
Okay. So, Kenneth has a point there.
No, he has a huge point. White children OD and die.
Absolutely.
And we have to have a commission to deal with heroin addiction
absolutely.
In our communities.
And it's a health issue now.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Which many of us have been saying for a long time. I want to thank all of our guests. Jackie Wellfounder, a political consultant at Wellfounder Group. It's always good to have you on the air with us. Thank you so much,
thank
Jackie.
You.
Neil
thank
Franklin,
you.
Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition.
Thanks,
always
Mark.
Good to see you,
pleasure.
My friend. Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Great to have you in the studio as well.
Thank you.
We're going to take a very brief break, and we're going to come in and come back to kind of wrestle with some of these same issues and some other issues from the perspective of another series of guests, all of whom are involved in the spiritual life of our world. Stay with us.